Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here.
Reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance.
Like your first home expansion.
Or your first big lightning strike.
There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents.
Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me is my dear friend Michael Walker. How are you doing, Walker?
Hello. Doing very well.
I'm glad to hear that. And I am Mark Bigney, and we're going to be talking about board games this week. We're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. We're not going to talk about tariffs. We talked about tariffs in Car Talk, the opening segment. We're not going to talk about it again. And then we're going to talk about our feature game this week, which is The Gibberers. And has the longest subtitle this is the longest subtitle since Trading and Negotiation in the Elysian Quadrant, which is from Sidereal Confluence. This is Gibberers, the word game of language invention and civilization development. There you go.
That's a mouthful. And so is the game.
It is absolutely both of those things. So, Walker, what did you play last week?
Well, Mark, Africa at NPI and Shut Up and Sit Down, both in their video contributions a couple weeks ago, talked about a game called Sausage Sizzle. And so I had to, I was intrigued.
You were a slave to the hype.
Well, Ian O'Toole is also included in this hype. So it's like, why are these people talking about this game? It is very much sort of an offshoot of Martian Dice. You're rolling eight dice. You must choose one. You could choose more. And then you roll again until, you get down to the dice that you want. What you're trying to do...
the dice that you end up with.
What you have is four animal dice that are six different animals, and then you have four numbered dice, which are two fives, a sausage, a two, and a three. And so your best roll is four of the same animal and all high numbers, because when you're done, you take your lowest number and you multiply it by one of the animals that you've collected, and you can only score each animal once. So you're going to be rolling six times throughout the game, trying to get a score, with the hook being sausages are worth 1 point unless you roll all sausages, in which case they're worth seven.
Which thematically doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I mean, the entire theming is weird. I appreciate that it's less represented Australian animals like the echidna, for example, or the quokka, or a variety of other things that you don't see as often. It's charming, and the theming of the game is nominally around how some sausages are consumed in Australia, apparently with a slice of white bread to nestle the sausage. But generally speaking, when it comes to sausages, one or two sausages is the number of sausages you want. But one or two sausages in this game is bad. You want sausages. It's either an entire sausage, a string of sausage, or you don't want any sausage.
Yes, because that's what it works out to. You'll get the animals you want. You'll start rolling your fives, and everything looks great. And you're down to your last number die, and you roll the sausage, and you got sizzled.
Is that you're trying to come up with a catchphrase?
Did it work?
I'm not sure.
Oh,
I'm not sure.
All right.
I don't understand the interest. It's fine. It's okay. You roll some dice. Things happen. But I think it is very similar to and manifestly inferior to a whole host of Reiner Knizia push-your-luck dice rollers. Heckmeck im Bratwurstmeck, a.k.a. Picomino, is probably my favorite of the bunch. It has the similar sense of pushing your luck. It has the similar sense of your options being constrained as the game goes on. And it also has an interesting trade-off in terms of what you select from your dice, because unlike in Sausage Sizzle, where you more or less want to take the same type of die over and over, you can only take each value of die once in the context of Picomino. So you roll your dice and you figure, okay, well, there are a couple of fives there. Fives are good. Do I hold out for more fives in a subsequent roll, or do I just take the one because there's only one of them? Anyway, I find that trade-off interesting, and it's an additional level of nuance that Sausage Sizzle doesn't have. It was okay. I mean, I'm not desperately asking for my 20 minutes back, but it didn't really grab me.
Well, I purposely played with Louis because he went through the trouble of buying Martian dice, and he enjoys playing that. So I wanted him to
Louis
try this
dice.
One. Well, he likes merchandise.
Wild. Okay.
And so, and he enjoyed Sausage Sizzle as well. So he, you know, talked about the decision space that is there. He, you know,
really?
He had more of a
he waxed
thought than
poetic
I did.
About the decision space of Sausage Sizzle.
He did. I said, all right, I agree no. with you that there is,
wow,
in quotation marks, a decision space there, but
that's wild. Let me tell you something, and this is coming from me, okay? I have a great deal of love and affection for Louis, and I mean this as a compliment. That man can talk. This is me saying that, all right? And so I guess it doesn't surprise me that he can hold forth on almost any topic, but of all the topics to hold forth on, the decision space and Sausage Sizzle, woof.
And that,
there's not a whole lot of meat on that bone. Hey!
So that is Sausage Sizzle, designed by Inca Brand and Marcus Brand, put out by 25th Century Games.
Played a game called Landmarks. This was published by Floodgate Games last year, designed by Rodrigo Rego and Danilo Valente. This is another co-op word game, and it's kind of the same vein of Codenames, except it's pure co-op, there are no teams, and there's a spatial element. You have this hex grid, and at the start of the game, the clue giver knows what each hex on the board represents, and they start off with three specifically designated clues. So, for example, you might have coffee and rat and table, and those are your three clues, and it tells you where to put them. And then what the clue giver gives is on these dry erase hex tiles, they write a clue, and then people decide where to put this clue in relation to the existing words on the hex grid. You might say, oh, okay, well, the person wrote furniture. Furniture relates to table, but it doesn't relate to rat or coffee. And then someone says, oh, well, I don't know, you put coffee on furniture. Maybe we should put it so it's touching both of those, or something along those lines. These are not what I would call good examples.
A coffee table.
You get the gist. At any rate, then the clue giver announces what the result is of placing on that space. There are traps and there are curses and you're trying to get treasure and then find the exit. So the clue giver is trying to guide you that way. It was all right. Part of the issue is that it lends itself an awful lot to one word clues. Like if you want to plan things out, and in many map arrangements, it is encouraging a lot of clues that only connect to one word because you're trying to make a beeline to a certain part of the map. Whereas things like Codenames get interesting when you're trying to connect multiple things together at once. Landmarks sometimes does that, but not nearly as much as Codenames, and it doesn't have that added wrinkle that appeals to me in the sense that Just One does. Just One, the wrinkle of Just One relates to the clue giving of the words. Now, for those of you that haven't played Just One, I'm just picking this as an example. There have been a bunch of really interesting word games. We're going to be talking about word games a lot more later on in the context of this episode. But in Just One, if you give a clue that somebody else has given, then they're erased and people don't get to see it. And so there's this additional level of second guessing related to the actual clue you're giving. Rather than this grafted on spatial element to how you're giving the clues, which influences just the specific types of associations people want to make, it felt clever and cute, but it's not as much to my taste as the other possibilities exist. I will note, just for the sake of the record, this particular session was one of those sessions where the clue giver looked like he wanted to murder us by the end of the game because nothing quite went the way he wanted it to, and we were making associations that were directly at odds. There was a somewhat tense discussion at the end of the game of the how on earth or why would I variety. All that I could do was bury my face in my hands and laugh. But such is the nature of things. So that's Landmarks. Perfectly pleasant, but in the crowded field of cooperative word experiences, I don't think it as good as things like So Clover or as Just One. So
is Landmarks the one that we have here, the one where you're doing the different landmarks on the up, left, right,
no,
and you're traveling? No, what's up?
Word Traveler.
Word Traveler. So how would you compare it to Word Traveler?
They're very different in that the spatial element of Word Traveler relates to specific pictures on the board. There's no real visual element in Landmarks. The spatial element is purely notional. Again, there's this sense of disconnection. It feels like it doesn't really hang together as well. And Word Traveler is okay. I think, all told, I would rather play Word Traveler than Landmarks, but not my preferred iterations on the genre.
I got to play Scarabre. This is the new offering from Shem Phillips at Garfield Games. And we just finished playing Gnar, and it has an interesting association with that game because what you're doing is that there's a draft. You're drafting these clan members. There's this famous archaeological site in Scotland that they found. That is one of the earliest, almost fully intact sort of village that they found. And that's what this game is based on. And so you're drafting these villagers, and they go into your tableau, and they create rows of like colors, and you're going to run the whole line, just like you do in Gnar. And then after you've done that, it's the way that the reason this game shines a little bit is because everyone's doing things almost at the same time after the draft. Like you draft a card, you put in your tableau, and then you have some workers to place. But everyone can do this at the same time. You have this, you have like 12 different little buildings that you can activate. And on the first round, you get one worker, and you increase workers every round until you have four, and then the game is over. So you're upgrading these buildings, you are activating to get resources, you are doing all sorts of different things. You're trading, which ups you on a track. You're furnishing your areas.
You gotta have tracks.
You gotta have tracks.
Yeah.
Furnishing track goes up. You need to feed the villagers that you've drafted. There are other things in the draft other than villagers, so you can sort of decide, I don't want any more villagers, I can't feed them. So there's like roofs or materials in there that you can draft instead. And there's a way to get roofs. Roofs just strictly reduce the number of villagers that you need to feed, one for one. So roofs, very important. You get roofs also from cleaning, because there's also sort of a, you know, mess, dirt, garbage, waste.
Did they build buildings in a radically different way in Neolithic Scotland? I'm confused.
No.
Okay.
So there's a waste element as well. And there's a whole sort of storage mechanic. You have this giant storage house, and you can increase it as much as you want. But the more you increase it, the more garbage and dirt you produce. And there's only one way to reduce it, and that's cleaning. You got to spend a bunch of resources. You get rid of some of the trash that you've, that also takes up storage space. So you can get in this spiral, right, where you need to increase, need to add more, therefore have to increase it, therefore get more garbage. So you get a cleaning value, you reduce it. You can, that's the only way you can move your little track down to, you know, lessen your space, but also lessen how much garbage you're producing. You can also cook food. There's a plethora of resources, Mark. It's kind of foolish. You just dump this giant bag of elk and rabbits and sheep and cows and flint steel and hides and fish and anyway, just this giant thing. And you can, so you get it. The only sort of, you know, hurdle there was for people is that the way they did their iconography a bit, like for cooking, it says 1 through 6. So it would make you think that you can cook 1 through 6 things, but it really is like sort of a point value, because every animal had how many points it takes to cook that thing. So 1 through 6 meant you could cook a cow at 4 and an elk at 2, you know, and
I see.
There's your 6 points. So odd that way. But anyway, so, but then that's bad as well. You think, great food, you can get to feed your people, but they're like sort of a resource pinata. They don't only give you food, but you know, you cook a cow that took up 1 space in your storage, and now it's 2 food, 2 bone, and 2 hides. and now you need to fit all of this into your grid somehow. Anyway, I enjoyed it. I think it's the best one that I've played so far from Garfield Games. When I also played it, also enjoyed it very much. This was a game brought to us by Warm Boy, by the way. So thanks to him for lending it. And I'm looking forward to it. And it plays very quickly. Like I said, other than the drafting of the single card, also going to the weird mechanic about, you know, passing. They have this little try counter that you put in things, so you can pass the draft and pick last in that particular row, which means you'll draft first in the next row. So you only move your token once, and everyone moves it twice. It's just this odd way of tracking turn order that, you know, in both games, we forgot to move or manipulate properly, and I really can't think of a way to fix it. But anyway, that was also quote unquote fiddly. Anyway, it is inoffensive, and I wouldn't mind showing it to you because it does not take that long to play.
Yeah, I mean, I've been burned by Shem Phillips and Garfield Games in the past, but if you say that it's promising, and it certainly seems to be less of a time commitment than a lot of their other games, I'd certainly be willing to give a shot.
And that's Scarabray. It was also streamed, so if you're interested in watching us play it, you can go to our live channel and see it streamed. The other game we streamed was Moving Company. So this is a game that the only information I had on it was pictures. There was no rule book. There was barely any information. It was just pictures of everyone had a moving truck in front of them, this like sort of cardboard large model moving truck, and then a whole bunch of furniture, and it looked like there was stacking involved, some sort of dexterity element. And I said, I don't care, I'm in, it looks amazing. And sure enough, it was fun, was had by all. It says that it's a chill, you know, for children, says on the side of the box.
But the box isn't the boss of you, Walker.
Exactly, Mark.
Precisely insofar as you are an adult, you cannot be bossed around by a box, and thus you can decide what to do with your time.
Just so. This is designed by Zhou Jiaoyi and Wu Ying, and published by Wales Entertainment, and it is a good time. It doesn't take very long. It's very, very fast. There is a ton of furniture to build, so it's a bit of a bear to sort of set up for your first game, because you're building...
Are bears good at building furniture?
Yeah, you know, the claws are good at, you know, turning the screws and...
Wild.
And, yeah. So a ton of furniture to build for your first game. You also have to build all the trucks. But long story short, there's a card for every piece of furniture. You deal out, you know, the cards in some way. There are three different variants. So what we did, and there's supposed to be four rounds. So we just broke it up that way. The first round was the base game.
Oh, okay.
And then we just did every variant for layered three rounds, layered it on that way. So we got the full experience. You're going to get a subset of cards somehow, and then either you can look at them all and collect the furniture and try to build it so it's the highest, or try to build it so it's the lowest. You're trying to fit everything into the truck. There's one that's timed. There's one where you get your eight cards in a deck, and you have to do them in order. You flip them up, and you build it that way. So it's just a good time with dexterity and trying to fit things together and through. And
sounds evocative of junk art.
Just so.
In terms of, you know, manipulating height and flipping over cards and them corresponding to pieces that you need to place.
Comes with this ruler, which unfortunately folds, so you have to sort out where you're trying to measure.
Oh, no, that's not a good idea.
When you're trying to measure, you're trying to keep it straight.
Well, Junk Art gave you string. That's better.
That's true. String is better.
We should play Junk Art again.
Agreed.
Good times.
So if you have a chance, I don't know if I would suggest purchasing Moving Company, but if you have a chance to try it, it is very quick and a good time to be had.
Played a game called First Rat. First Rat is by Gabriele Ocielo and Virginio Gili. I thought that Virginio Gili's name rang a bell, and sure enough, he is a member of Architoca, so he was involved in co-designing Igizia, as well as Leonardo da Vinci in both its original version and in its Codex Leicester version designs, which I've very much enjoyed. He's co-designed a lot of things with the other Italian masters. There's a lot of collaborative design philosophies running out through there. And First Rat is very simple, but quite engaging. I was quite taken with it. Basically, the way that First Rat works, the theme is that you're a whole bunch of rats in a junkyard trying to mount a space program. Because, you know, why not? Apparently, the rats are under the misapprehension that the moon is made of cheese, and that's the motivating factor.
What else would they do?
I don't know. That's a good question. Phrased thus, I confess I don't have a good answer for that. But at any rate, you're trying to build spaceships, and do various things as rats in a junkyard. The way that works is there's this long track, and you have a number of rats. You start with two. You can unlock a couple over the course of the game. And the spaces by themselves don't do anything very interesting. So one might be get some cheese, which is a currency in the game, unsurprisingly, or get some rocket components, or get something else. And you can either take one of your rats and move up to five spaces up the track, or you can move all your rats up to three, so long as number one, they do not end up on the same space, and number two, all the spaces they end up on are of the same color. So the spaces on this track are staggered in terms of color, so what you're encouraged to do is set things up so you can have gonzo turns, where you have three rats activating three different spaces and getting lots of stuff. All the while, there's this significant pressure to go higher up on the track, because the later actions are A, better, and B, if you get to the end of the track, there's a lot of points to be had. So I very much enjoyed these different tensions in terms of efficiency and in terms of quality of actions. And there are some special powers that you can unlock and a whole bunch of other standard Euro stuff. But by and large, it's driven by this central tension. And if you're going to have an action efficiency Euro that has a clever action selection mechanism, you might as well lean into it as far as I'm concerned. And I think that First Rat did a very, very good job of doing that. You're constantly being pulled in a number of different directions. The cross pressure is real. The scoring systems are reasonably transparent. It's more or less a straightforward resource conversion issue. So you get a couple pieces, a couple bottles of vinegar and a couple boxes of baking soda, and that's the propulsion system of a rocket.
Obviously.
Look, we're not idiots. This is not my first rodeo. I've been to space. We know how this works. And that you cash that in, and if you're the first to cash that in, you'll get a bunch of points. So it's not quite like a recipe fulfillment system because everyone's participating on the same metrics, and that makes it a little bit more straightforward. It leads to a tighter resource economy, and which again leads into the simplicity. I very much liked how focused First Rat was in terms of navigating the central tension of moving up the track, and how and when to unlock a new rat, and how and when to go further, when it's more efficient to go further as opposed to going with lots of rats. It's a whole thing. I liked it. It's inoffensive. It's very low barrier to entry as far as light middleweight Euros go, and it was very clever, and I felt torn in a number of directions, and so I would recommend First Rat. It was published by Pegasus Spiel in 2022. I don't know how many legs it's got. There's a variable setup on the other side of the board. We played with the standard setup this time. And not entirely unlike Pegasus Spiel games of the past few years, there are a ton of optional modules and a whole bunch of mini expansions and stuff like that. They love that kind of stuff. And so I don't know if that adds significantly to the variety. Again, the core issue is how efficient can I be with my rats in terms of getting these resources? And I'd be very curious to try again. That was First Rat by Gabriele Ossiello and Virginio Gili.
Mark, you and I got to play Barbecubes. This is sort of in the same line as Tinder Blocks, and they're all little, you know, mint tin games. This is designed by Brett J. Gilbert and Rob Sparks, put out by Alley Cat Games. And it is adorable, just like Tinder Blocks is. You dump out all the parts into the lid, you put the mint tin in the middle of the table, and it has these little grills that you lie across, and that's your barbecue. And then just like Tinder Blocks, you're flipping cards. It'll tell you which pieces of meat that you need to put on the barbecue and which hand you need to do that with these nice little white useless tweezers that they give you.
Yeah, and you not say useless, nice, but yeah.
And not useless in a bad, like not as in a bad component way. Useless, like perfectly designed to make it harder for you to pick up pieces and such.
Yes, they are ideal. If they were slightly more or slightly less functional, I don't know that the game would be as delightful as it is. I confess, though, I was a little disappointed by Barbecubes because Tinder Blocks is awesome. I really like Tinder Blocks. Tinder Blocks was done by Rob Sparks alone and published as well by Alley Cat Games 5 years ago. And Brett J. Gilbert is the co-designer for Barbecubes, and he did the Guild of Merchant Explorers and a bunch of other things. And so I was hoping that Barbecubes was going to be a sort of evolution riff on the gameplay elements of Tinder Blocks. But if anything, in terms of gameplay, it's a step backwards. Visually, it's very, very cute. It's like this almost pixelated look for these pieces of meat. And, you know, you got little sausages and little hamburgers and little turkey legs and things of that nature. And
don't forget the bacon.
And bacon, sure, fine. I don't genuflect at the altar of bacon the way so many people do.
Bacon.
That seemed to be a big cultural moment about 10 years ago. Thankfully, it's largely passed. We don't put bacon in everything anymore, which is great. Look, I like bacon just fine. Anyway, moving on. But the problem is, all you're allowed to do is stack on a single layer. Because, you know, thematically, that makes sense. I was initially asking, wait, so can I put things on top? And you just observed, that's not how you barbecue things. You don't put the slab of beef on top of another thing of meat that you're grilling. Of course, that makes sense. But consequently, all you're ever doing is the same thing. And I respect the fact that dexterity games tend not to be, especially tiny little mint tin versions of dexterity games, don't tend to be paragons of variety or evolution or arc or development or anything. But normally in a stacking game, things progress. You stack on top of things as opposed to just looking for more surface area to exploit.
Well, like I said, I think it's just two different arcs. One is building up high, waiting for a catastrophic fall, and then the game is over. This is trying to eke out bits of the grill, trying to make, you know, fit on your meat. Well, you know, and the space quickly disappears. And the fact that, you know, two mistakes and you're out, I think leads to, you know, quick gameplay and you just reset and go again.
Yeah, no, it's fast enough. I'm not utterly offended by anything that happens in Barbecubes. It's just I found Tinder Blocks to be more interesting, both visually, because the pieces are less immediately adorable, but you start stacking things up, and I'm not going to say it looks exactly like a fire, but it looks vaguely evocative of a campfire, whatever, and there's a sense of evolution. You're doing different things, different stacking challenges. You're putting wood in different arrangements and fire in different arrangements and these kinds of things. And so consequently, I felt that Barber Cubes was kind of a step back. Visually, it's a step forward because the pieces are great. But ultimately, I prefer stacking challenges to have a little bit more variety to them.
Agreed. And that's Barber Cubes by Alley Cat Games.
Got to play Unstoppable. Unstoppable is a new solo / two-player cooperative deck-building game by John D. Clare. This is part of Renegade Game Studios' series of solo games. They theme them around heroes. They have a little bit of fluff text associated with them. The Proving Grounds by Kane Klenko was the inaugural instance of this title. Warp's Edge by Scott Alms has also been in the series. Those are the two of these games that I've played before. And I've enjoyed both of those a fair deal. The Proving Grounds is very much like Kane Klenko's other dice games. If you played one Kane Klenko dice game, you've got a pretty good taste of his idiom, and I enjoy it for what it's worth. And Warp's Edge was a sort of bag builder, which is another genre that I very much like. But Unstoppable is riffing on John D. Clare's kind of card crafting system in a way. So every round, you add a new card to your hand from an available supply, and you level up, being able to get access to better and better decks of cards. But that card gets associated with a threat. You immediately sleeve it into a threat of something. So when it's in your hand, it's the good kind of card, but then it's going to go into the discard pile, and eventually it's going to cycle through to be a threat. Every turn, you've got three threats facing you, or more, depending on keywords. And it describes itself as a game of momentum, and that's very much true, because more or less every turn you want to dispose of those three threats, because if they stay on the table, there are two problems with that. Number one, they're going to be doing damage to you, so you might lose. And number two, you don't draw cards by default at the start of your turn. You get the one new card every turn. The way you draw cards is by defeating threats, because again, on the other side of the threat is a card that you picked, or a starting card, or what have you. And so there's this pressure to keep going constantly, turn by turn by turn. Now, there's a lot more else going on, and it's a surprisingly involved experience. I was expecting something roughly within striking distance of the complexity of one of the Realms games or of Shards of Infinity, but it's much more in-depth than that. This is not a 30 to 45 minute just do damage as fast as possible to the boss kind of deal. In point of fact, you cannot do damage to the boss by default. You need to exploit the boss's unique mechanisms in order to do damage to it at all. Normal damage is only done to threats. And there's this weird interplay with upgrades, and that's another thing you sleeve into cards. Some cards care very much about upgrades. It leans very, very, very heavily into the mechanism introduced by the Realms games, namely, do you have another card of the suit available in order to trigger special abilities? And you spend a lot of time navigating that on top of your action point limits and your money limits and all these other things. So I was expecting a very simple 30 to 45 minute thing. Instead, I got a much more in-depth 60 to 75 minute experience. But I have to say I was impressed. You don't see a whole lot of pure deck builders of this weight anymore. Like the sort of Dominion mold, we've kind of moved into a somewhat bifurcated arrangement where you either use deck building as a component in a much larger game experience, like Mage Knight. Every game's like Mage Knight now. Or something like the Imperium games. Make no mistake. I guess I mean both sets of Imperium games, whether it's Dune Imperium or Imperium Horizon / Legends / Classics. There you go. Or it's a much more simple game experience, whether it's something as incredibly simple as Abandoned All Artichokes or something as relatively simple as Shards of Infinity. So here we have like a middleweight, relatively pure deck builder experience, which is not a well-trod territory anymore. And it felt like kind of a return to form in that sense, but nonetheless utilizing a lot of contemporary design philosophies. And again, John D. Clare's card crafting element. I've been somewhat lukewarm on a lot of John D. Clare's designs. I don't really like Mystic Veil at all. I don't really like a lot of his other card crafting games. I did enjoy Rolling Heights, although not entirely disconnected to the fact that you then play a Gonzo dexterity game to destroy the city you built. But John D. Clare is usually a designer I have a wait-and-see attitude with, but Unstoppable is really kind of clever and cool. I'm looking forward to going back to it, seeing more of the cards, seeing more of the effects, seeing how the other bosses work. My understanding is from some people that I trust, like Chris Farrell, that the different bosses don't provide a whole lot of variety. But at a minimum, what the bosses do is they determine the deck of threats that you'll be facing. So there's four decks of threats in the base game, and every boss tells you to include two of them. So there's that at a minimum. And I enjoyed playing around with some of the cards, and the universe is a pretty colorful sci-fi one with some revolutionary mantises, so it's hard to say no to that. And I confess I'm very impressed. Now, the two-player version, I'm told, is significantly longer. I don't know if the engine is good enough to bear that kind of weight. As I said, at around 75 minutes, I think it's a pretty good experience. I don't know if I'd want to endorse it at 90 to 120, but time will tell. I'm going to be playing Unstoppable again. That's by John D. Clare, published by Renegade Game Studios this year in 2025. And it's very, very promising. High hopes.
You were nice enough to show us Battle of Mechaverse. This is designed by Reiner Knizia and published by Kids Logic. This is a...
Kids don't have logic.
This is a re-implementation of Clash of Gladiators by Reiner Knizia. And I think they hit it just right. Here's like the standard grid of squares that you're moving on, and you're playing giant robots, and you get to build your own robot the way you like it, and they don't mess around with movement that much. There is movement. There is a little bit of, you know, figuring things out, but it's at a perfect level. You know, you move along a whole edge, or you have jump packs that let you move anywhere. The only negative I have on it is it's a little ambulance chasing, but it really doesn't give you that much of a benefit. It does give you 2 points, but, you know, there are chances to get 2 points by attacking any other robot anyway. And so you're shooting or hitting robots with your, you know, giant sword with, you know, power fists, or you're, you know, launching rockets or sending the giant nuke, or, you know, all different ways you can build your giant robots, which is, you know, the beginning. It's like a two-phase game. You're deploying and building robots, which is fun, and then you're beating each other up. We played it at 3 players, and I think they did a great job.
I'm still coming to terms with the changes. I played Classic Gladiators a lot, and they're a much smaller universe of upgrades. And the big thing that I'm finding disorienting, this isn't a plus or a minus, this is just a big change, is the value of defense. Because of the movement rules in Battle of Mechaverse, you say it's very simple and straightforward, and it is. But generally speaking, when you activate your robot, you have a small number of targets that you can attack. In Clash of the Gladiators, the map was so much smaller, and consequently you could attack more or less anybody you wanted to. Everyone was clustered around in a much smaller environment. Consequently, this was an interesting dynamic in Clash of the Gladiators. If your units were too well defended, no one would attack you, which was bad, actually, because you score points by killing things. And if no one's attacking you, you're not counterattacking, you're not getting kills. Similarly, your shield dudes are occupying valuable spaces that could be occupied by guys giving you dice. Battle of Mechaverse upends that formula in 2 ways. Number one, smaller number of targets from which to choose. And number two, you can pick single components that are specialized towards attacking at certain ranges, either melee or range. And thus, the opportunity cost in some instances of taking a shield is lower. Both times I played Battle of Mechaverse, the last player standing won handily, whereas in the context of Clash of the Gladiators, the last player standing wasn't necessarily the one who won. Largely speaking, in these games, you score points for kills, and if you're the last one standing, you score everything you've got on the board as if you had killed it. And so there's a value to defense, obviously. But as I say, the biggest difference here is that there's been a fundamental change towards the balance of what the various components are worth. And this so far intrigues me. This is exactly one of the reasons why I love trying second editions, why I love trying redevelopments, and I love seeing talented designers and talented developers and publishers. I don't know how much Kids Logic had to do with this. They're a very small outfit, and they don't have much output. So this could be Reiner Knizia himself or his playtesters or whatever. It's always difficult to speculate once teams are involved. But riffing on ideas, developing on prior ideas, evolving, changing, modifying. And so I'm still at that stage of being like, oh, this is different. And I very much enjoy Battle of Mechaverse. I definitely like the system. I like the elements of continuity with the system of Clash of the Gladiators. And I'm mostly just now trying to compute the new game state, which is interesting. And so I don't know, I'm not in a position yet whether to say I prefer this version or the Clash of Gladiators version, but I can definitely say they're both worthy.
That being said, the person that won our last game didn't have any shields at all. So I don't know what that says.
That is an excellent point. I could be completely wrong about everything. Maybe we should name the podcast after that.
it could be the perception, right? Because when you see someone that has a bunch of shields, you might feel as though you need to attack them, right? So maybe I'm not maybe sure that equals it out. I'm not sure how it goes, but
Walker,
like you said, times
will
tell.
You've shattered my sense of the truth of the universe, and I'm just here trying to piece back together my value system. All right, could I just have a moment?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Played another game of Dorf Romantic, the board game, pulled this out after a while. This is the purely co-op version of the cozy tiling PC game of the same name, except the PC version, they don't call it the board game, which is good because that would be very confusing.
Can we blame them for the introduction of cozy? Because that was quite a while ago. Can we lay it all on their table?
I don't know. I just think it was... Why would we have been in a mood for cozy experiences about 5 years ago? Can you think of anything that was happening around that time?
Nothing that...
would make people want to have a nice, warm, comforting kind of...
No.
Okay, well, we'll have to think about
this
I'm
sure
later.
I blocked it out, though.
Yeah. Now, in terms of people jumping on a trend and overusing a marketing buzzword, no, I don't think we can blame Dorf Romantic for that, because they were very much at the tip of that particular spear. So, Dorf Romantic, the board game, is by Michael Palm and Lucas Zack, published by Pegasuspiel, and it is a very pleasant co-op experience. You're doing a score attack, and so there's no real win or loss. That's not my preferred way to play a co-op game, frankly. I prefer it when I'm playing solo or co-op, for there to be definitive win conditions. More on that later. And so to that extent, it is difficult to regard it as a very optimizing experience, but that's kind of the vibe, right? If there were definitive win or loss conditions, then maybe it wouldn't feel quite so cozy, and that's not evocative of the board
game. Yeah, I was going to say, it says cozy, and it definitely falls into that. You're creating this like quaint little villages and forests, and there's the train that goes through, and you get that feeling of when you, like just like Carcassonne or any other tile layer, when you flip up the tile and it's exactly what you need. It has that river that goes from to the right board edges and has the mountain on this side that fits in just right, and you slide it into place. Not only does it fit in that place, but also, you know, scores two different goals. And anyway,
I confess the one part that was a little tricky about going back to it after a while was tracking what we had unlocked. And some of the things you unlock in Dorf Romantic are achievements to be satisfied, and there's not a really good way to track with the provided tracker sheet for your campaign or with the other components whether or not you just unlocked the achievement or whether you've satisfied the achievement that you've unlocked, because those are two different things. It gets a little tricky. So we had to kind of re-remember where we were and reestablish a new sorting mechanism to make it more clear going forward. That's a minor problem. It doesn't get very complicated at any point. Most of the special effects require just the briefest mention to remember how they work, and then everything's fine. So it's not a huge deal, frankly, which is good. You want a low bar of approachability here, a low rules load for a game like Dorf Romantic.
Yeah, they have a nice balance, right? You always have three objectives going, like you need a village of this size or a forest of this size or a rail of a certain length, and gaming it out by keeping some at a certain size so you can use them later and putting garbage tiles where they need to go at certain times and sussing out the map. I think it's just the right level that and the right amount of time for this game.
That's Dorf Romantic.
So a game is coming out this week called Toy Battle. This is by a designer that we enjoy, Paolo Mori and Alessandro Zucchini. And I don't know what to think about this game, Mark. I've played it several times on Board Game Arena. And the first few times I played it, it was like, oh, it's just like that, you know, app game that you see all the time where I have a 5 and I have to, you know, there's all these enemies. And I have to make sure my number is higher than that number. It's like, oh, I beat the 4 and so now I'm at a 9. So now I can beat the 8 and now I get a little higher and higher and higher. And it's got a stratego element. So long story short, picture sort of a lattice between our two bases. And everywhere where the lattice connects, you get to put units, and there's all sorts of different units that are toys, and some of them have special abilities, but they all have a number, 1 through 9. And so you're placing them out, and there's two ways to win. Either you place one of your units in your opponent's base, or in the center of the lattices, there are some stars. And if you surround it, you get those stars, getting a certain number of stars, you win. And so you go out, and when you're adjacent to your enemy, you may put higher numbers on top of lower numbers. And they're all, like I said, there's also special abilities that let you just straight out destroy. There's the rubber duck that doesn't have a number that you get to put on, you know, any number that you want. be it the nine or whatever.
Sure.
There's the monkey that you can place anywhere. It doesn't need to be adjacent, but you know, you can't place off of it later. You know, it has to be a chain from your base.
Well, the monkey's a loner.
The monkey is a loner.
It's a lone wolf kind of deal. You know, walking in slow motion away from the explosion kind of deal. Everyone knows that about monkeys.
It's true. So a lot is to be said by the fact that I keep playing it. I have a game going right now. There is some interesting, there's also an interesting balance of when to draw more tokens, because you have a little tray that you put them on. So you start with five, you're allowed to have up to eight. So you're playing them out. And so when to forfeit playing a tile and draw two instead, or there's two tiles that you draw more tiles. So playing those at the right time to get the right momentum. Not sure. It is designed by Palomori, so I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. And keep playing to see if there is something there. That is Toy Battle.
Got to show Walker Dungeon Twister, the card game. It's by Christophe Bélanger, designer of Rise and Fall, which we talked about more recently. And this is the card version of his Dungeon Twister game. This was released shortly after Dungeon Twister 2 Prison was released. And the card game is much, much lower rated on BoardGameGeek, but I vastly prefer the card game version to the board game version for two reasons. Number one, the card game version is a small, portable, affordable version that involves a lot of the expansions. If you get a base game of Dungeon Twister, you're going to get a cast of 8 characters. And if you want more kinds of characters, more asymmetry, more stuff to play with, you need to buy expansions. And indeed, there were a number of very hard-to-find expansions for Dungeon Twister 1, and they were mostly cross-compatible with Dungeon Twister 2, although not really, and that was a whole thing. But the card game comes with an entire rowdy cast of characters from the expansions all integrated into the base game. I loved that. And number two, this is more of a personal preference. In Dungeon Twister, the board game, you had a grid map where you would be counting out squares. Okay, my move value is 6. 1, 2, it's okay. Your move value is 5. If I move here, can you get within range? Oh, not quite. So let's move over there. And as I expressed to Walker, there's only one game where I'm really willing to count squares anymore, and that's Space Hulk. And let me tell you, Dungeon Twister is no Space Hulk. The card game version of Dungeon Twister reduces the movement to area movement. So a given tile isn't going to be a 10 by 10 grid or whatever. It's going to have 5 large areas through which you move. And so movement capabilities now are more like 2 rather than 6. And consequently, that lets you focus more on the tactical parameters rather than engaging in too much counting and recounting. And so that's just a thing I don't like to do anymore. Dungeon Twister is probably the most puzzly game I really enjoy. And it's all about trying to figure out who can get where and do what. And the map is deliberately terrible. It is just really hard to get from point A to point B. And that's a large part of the game.
It's riddled with pits and walls. And you can't get over the pits unless you fly or have a rope or, yeah.
So maybe you need to get the rope in the hands of the flying character who's then going to fly it over to the person who can't fly. And then they're going to go. So that's exactly what happened. Like I had my... In Dungeon Twister, it's the kind of game where I give my Dark Angel the rope, and Walker's like, why are you doing that? The Dark Angel can fly. And the Dark Angel flies and drops the rope at the feet of the Goblin. Goblin races over all the pit traps out the exit, and the special ability of the Goblin is, he sucks, but he's worth more points. And so I got to pocket those points. That's the kind of stuff you're doing in Dungeon Twister. Meanwhile, there was a situation in the game that didn't manifest that I was thinking, I was like, okay, well, if I spend the action points of this person to rotate this room in, the other way, ooh, that puts them in line of sight and range of my wizard with the fireball spell, and so he can nuke one of them, and that'll be worth a point or something. Lots of little calculations like that. The biggest downside to Dungeon Twister, the board game, is how the board state is represented. Long story short, every tile has 4 rooms. And you take a character card and you rotate the character card such that the symbol of the room is at the top. So my little Naga, for example, could be in the circle room. And the way you do that is you put the card for the Naga next to that card and you rotate it pointing to the right room. It is pretty difficult to eyeball what's going on in a given room as a consequence.
Yeah, in a game that is so puzzly that you need like certain items and certain rooms, and the items work the same way. You have to put the item next to the room. It's got to be rotated. So the color of the area that the item is in is. So when you're trying to figure out like an 8 piece combo and you're not sure where pieces are.
Or even just a two or three piece combo, frankly. Finding out or identifying where a single thing is borderline trivial. Trying to figure out where one thing is in relation to one or two other things, much more difficult.
So Mark was nice enough or smart enough to put a bunch of meeples and discs in with the game. So you just simply put the disc.
Can't I be both smart and kind and sexy? Wait, did I? I think I might have inserted one of those.
I think you had.
Yeah.
So it, you know, it doesn't you know say that's the actual Naga, but you know that there's someone in that room, and you can suddenly just look over. So you still track the same way.
Any set of tokens will do the job. I just happen to have excess meeples for characters and excess discs for items. And frankly, I think they really should have, in this small box game, just had a counter sheet, and that would have done it. Right? You don't need a standee for every character in the game. You can still use the card to indicate what room they're in. But then if you need to indicate what specific subsection of the room they're in, well, yeah, you then use the rotational element. And if you then need to disambiguate between the fact that you get two characters on the same card, one of them being the goblin, one of them being the Naga, and they're in different rooms, yeah, that's where you start using the rotational element. But if you have a visual touchstone on the room itself, just to indicate that you've got characters there, it makes a world of difference. So my sincere recommendation is for anybody who likes Dungeon Twister or who wants to get into Dungeon Twister, I think this is the version to get. I mean, granted, they're all out of print. They're all heavily out of print. There's supposed to be a 20th anniversary edition that's going to be coming out someday from Ludicali. There hasn't been a whole lot of news on that lately. But this is cheap and cheerful, or it was when I got it. Just sub in something, anything. All you need is something to represent characters and something to represent items in two colors, and it can obviate the biggest barrier of entry to Dungeon Twister, the card game. And it's my preferred version. And for what it's worth, it's super weird and super puzzly, but I very much enjoy it. It's a really good two-player experience.
Yeah, do not be fooled by the fact that it comes in a small box and it's called the card game.
Yeah.
Which usually, you know, says that
exactly.
Which you think you're going to get a lighter experience, which it is not.
Yeah.
It
has been simplified only with respect to the number of spaces that are being represented, not at all in the sense of the challenge of using the combinatorics and the special abilities and all of those elements. It is the full game. I agree with you entirely. That's one of the big problems of Dungeon Twister, the card game, that a lot of misconceptions people had. This is the full game. It's everything. So that's Dungeon Twister, the card game, designed by Christophe Bélanger, published by Asmodee in 2013.
So Mark and I got to play Rumble Nation. I brought this in because I know Mark brokered copies to people, and I was surprised to know that he had never played it either. And they got nothing but praise from people, so I decided to get a copy in because a new edition just released. And it is I don't want to say simple, but
it is simple.
It is a simple area majority that has some twists in it. You're rolling dice, you roll three dice, and you pair them up how you want. So it's either you pair up two dice that are going to give you a location, and the third die is going to tell you how many of your troops you're going to put in that location.
Yeah, so if I roll a one, a two, and a three, I can put the one and the two together and say I'm going to be placing troops into region of three. Or I can pair the two and the three together, in which case I'm placing troops into region five. Or you get the idea.
Yeah, it's a one, two, or three troops, depending on your roll, one, two, three, four, or five, or six. And you're at the beginning of the game, you randomly put out numbers in all of the territories. That number two to 12. And once everyone has put out all their troops, you're going to resolve each of those territories in order. So it's very important on where you put troops, because once you resolve to, if you win to, you get to put out what is called reinforcements, which means you can add two troops to every area adjacent to two where you already have troops.
So region two, which was only worth 2 points, you might figure, why on earth would I want to go there? Well, if it happens to be centrally located, it can help you win everything else that you're next to, because two troops is non-trivial. Now, an important proviso, you gotta be there in the first instance, which is sometimes tricky. So setting all this up, very, very simple rules of the game, but setting it all up so that you can have this sort of cascade of benefit of winning region after region, very tricky.
Yeah, and there's a sidebar of a few of cards where once during the round you can choose one of these cards, lets you move troops around or kill a troop, you know, lets you modify where troops are slightly.
Nothing particularly outré or consequential, but little interesting.
Yeah, so it's figuring out the puzzle, seeing which... And the other thing is that things will resolve. It's like, oh, you know, here's 10, and it's adjacent to all of these other territories, so I got to make sure I win 10, because that'll be great. I'll get reinforcements all around 10.
Already done.
Unfortunately, they've already resolved, so too bad. So yeah, so figuring out, like I always say, Marco Polo style, you need to analyze the board, figure out your strategies before the game starts. Know where you want to get troops.
Really? I'm shocked by that comment because, yeah, you can take a look at the board and try to notice the choke points and the important points of conflict, but you have to roll with what the dice give you at the end of the day.
True. You do get a re-roll where you can, you know, re-roll the dice and hopefully get where you want, but just knowing where not to put troops, I guess. Not only where to put them, but where not to put them.
Sure.
And that is Rumble Nation.
Designed by Yoji Shinichi and published by Hobby Japan originally in 2017, the new edition published this year in 2025. Actually, in the French version, it's called Sengoku, very much like a whole bunch of other games about the Sengoku Jidai. So the French version is trying to be a little bit more serious. Those are the games we played last week. Now a brief break to pay some bills.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
And we're back. On to the news and why it doesn't matter.
So SETI, the local group, has been very much enjoying SETI, so I'm glad that it's getting an expansion. It's going to be called SETI Space Agencies. So everyone's going to have their own unique power mark. You're going to be the corporation, so you'll be NASHammer, sending people to space, or other silly, you know, corporation names.
Wasn't that an industrial band in the 90s?
Three new aliens.
Oh, great.
And, of course, well, more cards, because this is very susceptible to just more cards.
Gotta have more cards.
So if you're enjoying SETI, you're going to get an expansion soon. And then we have Flamecraft Digital coming out, Mark. If you're too ashamed to ask your friends to play Flamecraft, well...
It's not that bad.
I know, I'm just... You can go to your Steam and purchase Flamecraft, the digital version.
Only if you're burdened with gaming with someone like Huey, who talks about baby games for babies.
And so I took a look at it this morning. It looks really neat. They've animated all the cards.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so the dragons move.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, and I think that completely changes everything.
I think they've made it, you know, they've multiplied the durableness of it. So more than likely, I will be picking it up just to give it a try.
Sure.
Flamecraft Digital. So I've been playing some Dice Throne lately. They're totally changing direction, and they're coming out with a game called Slam Throne, Mark. It's going to be a POG game. So you're going to have your
discs. Are you serious?
I am 100% serious.
POGs are coming back?
They're coming back.
It's been a punchline for decades.
I'm sorry, but they're on the throne now, Mark.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, which throne? Anyway.
Jay-Z and Kanye were right. You've got to watch the throne.
You got to watch the throne.
Wow.
You throw the pogs, you get the abilities. It might be a good time. We will see.
July 25th, 26th, and 27th in Kingston, Ontario is going to be SwagCon, a.k.a. Congress. So very wrong about games. Fun times, good vibes only. Trans rights are human rights. Board game jamboree. Open registration is now available on Eventbrite. There is a link to the URL of the episode notes where you can go get your tickets. There is room for you. We would love to have you there. Just be perfectly clear, although it is true that Buckethead, Olivia Rodrigo, and Chaka Khan are very welcome at SwagCon, and this is indeed a formal invitation. They're not coming. I just want to be very, very clear.
Yeah, we're not trying to be deceptive anyway.
We're not trying to be deceptive at all, and I realize that any time you make a joke on the internet is apt to be misconstrued. This is one of those jokes, you see, that is not true. I'm not saying that Buckethead, Chaka Khan,
and this is not with a, there's no wink here.
There's no wink here. They're not, like, no. I will say that if Buckethead wants to come and Buckethead just wants to play and doesn't even want to play any music, just wants to, like, I've got robot toys. I know Buckethead loves robot toys. We could talk about robot toys. We could do a whole thing. If he just wants to robot dance or even off just in the corner where no one watching, that's fine too. He wants to play with nunchucks, that's cool. All these things are cool. I will also say that we are now formally inviting Tim Robinson, Hannibal Buress, and Susie Izard to SwagCon. None of them will be in attendance either, but if they wanted to come, they're welcome to come.
Very nice.
So that is SwagCon. And by the way, just as a note, I realize this is not germane to the topic, but to our non-binary trans and queer listeners generally, but especially the non-binary and trans listeners, a number of you are living under states that are aggressively harassing you. We have no patience for that. We see you, we love you, and we're very sorry that you are burdened with governments that want to persecute you. It is nonsense. That is the news. And why it sometimes matters, Walker says, I'm sorry, I'm just upset lately, but not nearly as upset as a lot of other people because I'm not being personally targeted, but my friends and loved ones are. Now under our feature game, Gibberers, the word game of language invention and civilization development. This was designed by Keisei, published by Hobby Japan in 2024. There is an English language version that replaces all the Japanese cards with English. This is a redevelopment slightly more professional printing of a 2019 game designed by Keisei called Esperization. Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about how one gibbers?
Gibbers, Mark, is Damok and Jihad. It is not Shaka when the walls fell. I believe this game gets
it is Damok and Jihad and Tanagra.
I believe that this game is going to get as close as, in my mind, I can't think of any game that's going to get closer to creating a language in the amount of time that they give you, with the tools they give you, than this game does. You are writing down a base of, like, hot, cold, up, down, you know, warm, fast, slow.
You start with a vocabulary of 14 words of your choice. The first person pronoun, I, the verb to know, and yes, no. Those are the 18 words you start with.
And then you slowly build off of that, and you create this language, and you're yelling at each other. I would love to see the faces of people that come in mid-game of the Gibbers, because it would be amazing.
Because you're only allowed to, once the game begins, nominally, you're only allowed to speak in your new invented language. So you start with a vocabulary of 18 words. You're not allowed to use any English. You're not allowed to use any actual extant human language. And that is the means by which you communicate in this cooperative word game, whereby the some player draws a card and has to communicate to people around the table, like the word meat or something of that.
Yeah. So like Mark said, the one person is designated as the leader for this particular round. They draw a card. There are five different generations, and you have to do some sort of subset of those five generations, depending on the difficulty level that you're playing. The first few generations, you're allowed to use some gestures and hand language as well.
Yeah, the first two eras, you're allowed to use gestures and pantomimes. For eras 3, 4, and 5, you're not.
So I feel of course the language is a huge part of this game, but there is also a large part of the game in these cards. Because not only are you choosing, there's a whole list of words, so you have to choose one of those. You have to choose one that you feel you can convey. Also, you have to choose one that you think will be a good, like, once you start gaming this out more, you're going to choose one that is going to be a useful addition to the dictionary, because after they figure out the word, it's now added to your dictionary.
Succeed or fail, you do add the word to your growing lexicon.
And also, beside each word is a symbol. And so if you're successful, you get to add that symbol to your pool, and you can use these tokens to give you benefits later.
Mostly just to buy new words. An opportunity for you to just stipulate that a new word is going to be added to the lexicon. There are other ways to do this as well. So the sort of game elements surrounding the fundamental conceit, I think, are relatively well done. This idea that you're trying to build up your score in the game, and to do that, you need to build sets of icons from these tokens that you get if you do things successfully. These tokens can also be cashed in to get different benefits. And so when I'm about to be a clue giver, I'm balancing those two considerations. Based on the vocabulary that we have available and based on the crew that I know I'm dealing with, I suspect these words are going to be easier to get them to guess than others. But by the same token, I need to round out our inventory of tokens for both the end game considerations and mid game considerations. That kind of pulls me in the direction of doing this other thing. Like, for example, one of the category of tokens you can win are wonder tokens, and these relate to fantastical elements. Now, they are worth a lot of points. They also can serve as wild tokens and sub in for any other symbol. But the problem is, whatever you're going to get out of that word is not going to be useful for your later vocabulary. So during one of the games we had, one of the words was elf. Elf gives you a wonder token. Elf is useless in the context of, like, how are we going to use elf to clue off of anything else? It's just, it's sui generis. It's not helpful. But it's a super helpful token and super useful. So that's why I decided to go for that one. And those kinds of trade-offs, I think, are reasonably well done and help give an overall structure to gibberers that's pretty engaging.
So the other thing you get to do is, while you're trying to guess the word the person is gibbering at you, is that there are three different sort of clues or helpful things that they can do. They have these three large cards that have sort of like cave drawings on them, and all sorts of different things. Yeah, yeah. So you can throw down a token. You have another subset of tokens. Like, we'll call them guest tokens. So you can use a guest token, and then the leader can, you know, point to different pictures, or they'll probably be the one that, you know, uses that. They're allowed to throw in a token as well, because they might see something in these cave drawings that will, you know, aid in the guessing of the word. There's also, at the beginning of the round, you write down a new word, like not the actual meaning of the word. You say, you know, topar, and you write down topar, and that's going to be the support word. And you can either get the players to guess that word, or you, like we said, you can throw in a guess token and actually just write in the actual meaning of that word and use that to, you know, get more towards the...
Well, the number of guest tokens that it costs is actually a function of what game mode you're playing. There are two versions of the gibberers in the box. There's the basic game, and then there's the full game. They differ in two primary ways. Number one, the costing on some of the hints varies, and the specific version of the hints varies a little bit. And also, the advanced version is significantly longer. The basic version ends with an Era 3 card. You top it off with an Era 3 card. Era 3 roughly corresponds to Renaissance-ish in terms of human history. Whereas in the full version, you do a bunch of Era 3 cards and a fair number of Era 4 cards, which represent contemporary times, and then you finish with an Era 5 card, which is meant to represent the future. And it is considerably longer, and the balancing of hint tokens starts to become much more consequential, because things just broadly get more difficult, and you might have to flail around at guessing specific things. Like an example of this, by the time you get to Era 4, you're no longer talking about things like that are pretty fundamental elements of nature, like a bee or meat.
Rock
or something of that nature. Instead, you might try to guess the Great Depression, which, let me tell you, Huey had a devil of a time trying to get us to get it. We got the general gist of poverty. He actually was pretty good at he was able to, with our constructed language, express the idea that a large number of people had lost their homes, which in hindsight was a pretty impressive construction and was a pretty good way. But we didn't have a good sense, especially at the time, of what level of specificity the cards were going towards. The level 5 card that I had, which I thought I did a pretty good job of giving hints, but apparently not, was World War III, which, again, is a specific thing. It's not an idea or a thing in nature or anything like that. It's a very, very, very specific event or happening that is culturally dependent, and culturally dependent on our culture, which kind of runs counter to the theme of building a new civilization, but whatever.
And we almost got there. We got, you know, there was a really big war, and then something happened after that big war. We just couldn't get the fact that it was another big war. You know, we almost got there. There was ideas. It was,
yeah, I was able to say big fight, cold fight, big fight. Yes. I had the word after, I had the word event. People kept guessing specific wars, and I kept saying bigger, 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 bigger. And the historical progression was understood, but the parallelism with the fact that, you know, people, Huey understood that what I meant was World War I, World War II, Cold War, and then this thing that I was trying to clue you in, which I also described as big fight, but whatever.
Yeah, if we, I think we might have, if we thought again that it was the future.
Maybe you weren't so stupid.
And the fact
that... If I had future, well, no,
but we should have known that. Like, the fact that fives were things in the future, you know...
That's one of those things where, you know, it's kind of cheating. Like, if I'd been interested in sort of cheating, it occurred to me I could take out the rule book and gesture violently at era five that says it's the future because the guesses that were being posited were past events.
Exactly, yeah. Things that but
anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Just quickly, the last thing that you can do with these guest tokens is that you can just make up a word. Of course, that's going to be very expensive, and you're going to have to pay a lot of these guest tokens because how the round ends, like I said, you create this non-meaning support word, and then you get to add a certain number of guest tokens back into the pool based on the round that you're in. In the final round, you get one back, so good luck.
Yeah. By the end, you need those tokens desperately just to be able to make a single guess. So when it works at its best... I think that the Gibberers exercises a kind of magic. Like when you're fully in the zone, when you're not constantly looking down at what the words mean in English or whatever other language you happen to be playing in, and you're just, you know, gibbering at each other in this new language, it's really kind of cool. I find those moments fleeting in the Gibberers.
Well, like I was thinking, like I have written here is that it shows you how people's memories work differently. You had no problem internalizing the words and
That's not true. I kept forgetting certain words.
True.
And so I would be in these positions. It's weird because to gibber in English, this isn't just a pedantic point, but it gets to what I'm pointing at. To gibber relates to speed. It's to speak unintelligibly by virtue of how fast you're talking. You don't get fast, fluid speech in the gibberers. You get halting, clumsy speech, not just because you don't have the necessary syntax. That's fine, whatever. You're not going to develop a syntax in the context of the gibberers. But I could never remember that in one game we played, Huey had added to close as a word. I can never remember what close was. I'm like, oh, I remember that we have close in the vocabulary. Okay, so this is a thing, and then I'd stumble over close. I'm like, crap, and I have to go look at the 20 words to try to remember where close was and then start again and the whole thing. So,
true, but that was one word. A lot of the times that you were going quite fluently through the words, where the rest of us were pretty well word for word having to look down and remember, like I could not remember.
Or even just point, right?
Yeah.
It's... My point is this. My overall point in making this framing is that, again, when it works, it's glorious. But the thing is, there's a million and one ways in which it fails to work. And the full version of the game is long. And so you have this grueling, sometimes repetitive thing where you're just trying to scrabble together these different concepts. And I keep thinking to myself, the kind of magic that it conjures is somewhat akin to the kind of magic that's conjured by two CMYK games that are vastly faster. I'm talking about Wavelength and Wilmot's Warehouse. You're not making a new language in either of those cases, right? But when Wavelength works, which is often, and it's a much quicker game, you feel like you're telepathic. You feel like you're communicating with people on a very fundamental level, and you're vibing in that way that the gibberers wants to evoke. And in Wilmot's Warehouse, you're not making a new language, but you're making a narrative. You're making a shared universe of semiotics with these kinds of symbols. And so that sense, that magic of shared communication is evoked by these different games much quicker and much more successfully, I think.
Yeah, much smoother, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's even setting aside pure word-based games, right? If you want to play pure word-based games, I talked about this earlier on the show, you are spoiled for choice. Just one, so Clover, Codenames, Decrypto, whatever. If you want to play around with words in this way, you are drowning in opportunity to do so. And the sort of vaguely LARPish element of speaking in a language that you're constructing, the charm of that is real, but as I say, it's kind of fleeting and it's kind of underdone by the fact that you're at the end of the day just trying to get people to clue in and they either get it or they don't.
I very much enjoyed it. I would play it anytime. I have some misgivings as well.
Anytime, really?
Yes.
Regardless of the group?
No, that's what I'm going to bring up next, right? Because I really feel, like I said, someone coming in the middle of a game of Gibbers, they're going to be giving you weird looks. I don't know if this is a game night thing where you have people yelling at each other in this like weird language.
Yeah.
And it will tend to get loud, if not just the laughing and the silliness. They also just, you know, making up the silly words. And
not a whole lot of laughter. Gibberish is a pretty serious affair. Like, it's not, it's not madcap. It's much more, like, focused than that. Because, again, you're trying to concentrate on these word associations as well as actually playing the game. I don't remember all these moments of laughter. Like, just one wavelength, you get these moments of laughter and you get the reveal and you get all these things. No, the gibber is more...
I found it kind of amusing.
Well, no, I'm not saying that it was joyless, but I'm saying that in terms of mood, it's much more straight-faced than something like a more lighthearted party game. And we've experienced a number of people who, when trying to pitch the gibberers, like, hard pass. They, like, have no interest. Yeah. You have to be willing. I meant what I said. It's a vaguely LARPish experience. You have to be willing to commit. And that's another way in which the magic can be unsettled. If someone can't or won't commit, and it's difficult to maintain that commitment for the entire time, the magic also gets broken when people start asking rules questions, which are necessarily going to be in English. The game says once the game starts, you're not supposed to speak anything but the conlang, but obviously there are going to be rules questions. Those you have to address in language, unless it's expected to.
Yeah,
grunt.
And reminding what, you know, all the different ways the guesses work and how many tokens you have to
absolutely
spend.
Absolutely. And so, as I say, I'm not blind to the joys of the gibberers. I've enjoyed it, but it's a subtle and fragile magic that I think is better evoked by other experiences. I would much rather play Wavelength, Wilmot's Warehouse, or just one than I would the Gibberers. And on top of that, the two modes both strike me as unsatisfying in different ways. The base game I prefer for the length, and I also prefer that it has a definite end. You win or lose based on whether or not you get the age 3 card, and then you're done. But I don't like how the guess tokens are balanced. I don't like how the guess abilities are constructed nearly as much as I like it in the advanced game. The advanced game has a better sense of scope. It breathes. You get to see. You get to deal with more abstruse concepts and that challenge of, you know, going past identifying rocks and getting to very, very specific culturally situated things. But it's really long and grueling. And you don't have a definite victory or loss. It's just a score attack. And my personal preference is not for that.
Yeah, there was definitely moments where we knew we weren't getting the word. And it was just like repeating the same thing. Or, you know, trying to hit it from different angles. And it was just getting a little frustrating.
Yep.
Yep. And the fact that, like we said, you start off with all of these things are being written on these little notepads, these little sticky notes, sticky pads. So you're doing 18 just off the start. And then you're going to add another 10. So you're going through almost 30 of these things every game. And are you going to run out eventually? I don't know. I'm just saying it is.
They're not specialized, so it's easily proxied.
It is. I'm just wondering if they could add dry erase notes, or you could just use paper after the fact.
There'll be a lot of dry erase boards. Oh, my goodness.
It would be. But there would be some
30 little dry erase tablets, and then, oh, my.
I don't know. And the fact that it is $80. Because it is...
That's just an expensive import proposition.
It is.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like you said, because there are so many other games that we feel do it a little bit better, spending $80 to give this a try might be a bit much of an ask.
Yep. I don't mean to undercut how unique the Gibberers is. I'm constantly pointing to other games that conjure a comparable kind of magic, but I will say that I do appreciate the unique thing that the Gibberers brings to the table. And it's really quite cool in how much you're able to communicate in this very parsimonious language that you've erected. That's neat.
I feel
genuinely cool to experience.
It comes
that.
The closest, I think, any game will to creating an entirely new language.
Absolutely. But I will just point out that, yeah, but at the end of the day, in both the basic version and the advanced version, I feel that there are things holding it back. And those moments of magic, I think, are few and far between. And so ultimately, I was glad to experience it, but I don't think it's the kind of thing that I'm going to be going back to, frankly.
And that's the Gibbers.
The Gibberers.
The Gibberers.
Thanks very much for joining us. That's going to do it for this week for So Very Wrong About Games. We appreciate your deciding to spend the most valuable resource you have, your time and attention. Just for you, Chris Hayes. We hope to see you again soon. Take care of yourselves, take care of your hobby, and thank you, Rules Explainer.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.